A Contra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Contra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. You sent us a request to analyze a really fascinating book. It wasn't just about a crisis. It was published right at the moment that crisis really exploded.
Yeah, that's right.
Today, we are diving deep into E.H. Carr's monumental critique of international relations, The 20 Years Crisis, 1919-1939.
It's hard to overstate the impact of this one. I mean, imagine writing a history of a failed peace. You publish it in 1939.
Right, it's wars breaking out
exactly.
Again.
Exactly. And then you watch World War II ignite almost immediately. Carr had this devastating, almost prophetic insight into why the world order built after WWI just collapsed so spectacularly.
So our mission today is to, you know, cut through the academic jargon a bit and really get to his core message. What actually caused the collapse of that whole League of Nations system? Mm. And the answer Carr gives us is this fundamental tension, isn't it? The crisis basically stemmed from a dangerous disconnect between utopian hopes, what we wish the world could be.
You ought to be.
Yeah, they ought to be. And the harsh, unyielding realities of power politics, what the world actually is.
And to really appreciate that insight, I think you have to understand the author himself, E.H. Carr. He wasn't just some academic theorist locked away in an ivory tower.
No,
he was this rare combination, a leading thinker who actually started his career as a hands-on practitioner. He was a career diplomat, you know, in the British Foreign Office for 20 years, from 1916 right through to 1936.
Wow. Okay, so an insider. An insider turning against the very system he maybe helped build or at least operated within. That's often where the sharpest critiques come from, right?
Absolutely. He wasn't just reading the official papers. He was probably writing some of them.
He was there.
He was literally there. He was physically present at the Paris Peace Conference back in 1919. That's where the League of Nations, the Treaty of Versailles, all of that was hammered out. He saw it firsthand, the high ideals bumping right up against the grubby political deals happening in the background.
So he sees the blueprints being drawn up, heavily influenced by, say, Wilsonian idealism.
Right.
And almost immediately starts thinking, hang on, is this really going to work?
Yeah.
He develops this deep practical skepticism about using purely legal or moral language to fix problems that are at their heart about power.
Yeah.
About who has the leverage.
That's exactly it. His practical experience basically taught him that power often comes before morality in international affairs.
Yeah.
So when his book came out in 39, challenging this utopian system that had been the standard thinking for two decades.
Just as it was all falling apart.
Just as the system imploded. Well, his arguments carried immense weight. He was like the intellectual guide saying, look, I tried to tell you this dream wasn't going to last.
So, okay, what was Carr actually trying to do with this big critique? It sounds like more than just an I told you so.
Oh, much more. Yes, he wanted to perform a kind of political autopsy on the failed peace. That's true. But more importantly, he aimed to pivot the entire field of international relations, to shift it away from what he called the utopian fantasy.
The wishful thinking.
The wishful thinking, exactly. And towards a more sober, analytical, realist approach, grounded in how things actually work.
Focused on reality. And he argued the big mistake of that whole interwar period was buying into this harmony of interests idea.
Yes, the harmony of interests illusion. The idealists, you know, they genuinely seem to believe that if nations just acted rationally, used reason, their interests would naturally align. Peace would just happen.
Sounds lovely on paper.
Doesn't it? But Carr saw it as, frankly, delusional. He argued that international relations aren't about harmony. They're fundamentally an unending struggle, driven by conflict, by national self-interest, by the quest for power.
But, and this is important, he wasn't just a cynic, was he? He didn't just say, it's all power, forget morality.
No, and that's what makes the book so powerful, I think. He argues that effective statesmanship, real leadership, needs a synthesis. Pure idealism, that's naive, it leads to failure. But pure realism, just analyzing power, that's sterile. It tells you how things are, but gives you no direction for making them better.
So the real trick is to blend them.
Exactly. The true statesman has to pursue moral goals, have a vision for a better world, but do it while skillfully navigating the messy realities of power as they exist now. That blend, that synthesis, is his final crucial message.
Okay, that dual view is key. Let's really break down this dichotomy he sets up. the utopian versus the realist.
Right. So the utopians, these are the idealists. Their focus is aspiration, what the world ought to be. They put their faith in international law and morality and reason. They seem to believe that reality itself can be reshaped, reformed, just by sheer political will and good intentions.
Like the world is just a big classroom, and if everyone learns the right rules and behaves, it'll all be fine.
Kind of, yeah. Whereas the realists, they focus on the messy actual world, the what is. They emphasize cause and effect, national interests, power dynamics, and crucially, the constraints. What limits what states can actually do based on the distribution of power.
And Carr's big point here is that the whole interwar system, you know, the League of Nations setup, was fatally dominated by that utopian way of thinking.
Precisely. It ignored the fundamental constraints of power, and therefore, Carr argued, it basically set itself up for failure from the start.
Which leads us straight into his pretty brutal takedown of the harmony of interests.
Yeah, this is a core part of his critique.
Now, wait a second. Isn't world peace, you know, fundamentally in everyone's interest? Isn't that a universal good? Why wouldn't interests align on that?
Ah, but see, that is the utopian assumption. Carr says, hold on, this harmony of interest, this idea that the current world order benefits every nation equally, that's not some objective scientific truth.
It's what then?
It's an ideology.
An ideology used by whom? For what purpose?
Well, according to Carr, it's primarily used by the satisfied powers, the status quo haves, think post-WWI Britain, France, the U.S., the winners. They use this idea to justify and preserve an international order that, surprise, surprise, benefits them greatly.
Okay, so by defining their preferred status quo as universal peace or international harmony,
they get to label any challenge to that order as inherently immoral or disruptive. Any pushback from the dissatisfied have-nots, like a rising Germany or Japan feeling constrained by the post-war settlement, gets framed as an attack on peace itself.
So for those have-not countries, this supposed harmony didn't feel like peace at all. It felt like, what, a cage, a system designed to keep them down economically, militarily, after losing the war.
Exactly. For them, their perceived national interest wasn't in upholding this harmony. It was potentially in shattering the system. And that very conflict, Carr says, proves his point. International relations are fundamentally political, driven by power struggles, not by some shared universal morality.
Okay, so if conflict and power struggles are the engine, then power itself must be the fuel. Carr gives us a really useful way to think about power, doesn't he? It's not just about armies.
Right. He breaks it down. He sees power as multifaceted and argues these different forms shape how states behave much more than abstract legal principles ever could.
What are the key forms?
Well, the first one is obvious. Military power. You know, boots on the ground, tanks, ships, the final arbiter, the tool of coercion.
Standard stuff. What else?
Second, economic power. This is crucial. Using finance, trade, sanctions, controlling markets, using these as weapons, as instruments of national influence. You don't necessarily need to fire a shot to bring a country to its knees if you control its economy.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
And the third one, this one feels very relevant today.
Immensely relevant. It's power over opinion, the ability to shape beliefs, to use propaganda, ideology, control the narrative. This is how a state convinces its own people, and critically, the international community, that its own self-interested goals are actually universal goods.
Like spreading democracy or defending sovereignty or promoting free trade.
Precisely. This intellectual ideological power was, in Carr's view, essential for legitimizing that whole utopian structure that ultimately failed because it couldn't handle reality.
And that failure, that inability to handle reality, brings us to his analysis of peaceful change. Or the lack thereof.
Yes, the problem of peaceful change. He saw this as the fatal structural flaw in the interwar system, the League of Nations, the Treaty of Versailles.
What was the flaw exactly?
They were incredibly rigid. They were designed primarily to enforce the treaty signed in 1919 to basically freeze the status quo that favored the victors. But here's the thing. The distribution of power between nations is never static, is it? It's always shifting. New powers rise, old ones decline.
Right. Things change.
Things change. And Carr argued the system failed catastrophically because it provided no effective, legitimate way to revise those arrangements. No mechanism to accommodate the perhaps legitimate grievances or ambitions of dissatisfied rising powers peacefully.
So if the system doesn't allow for peaceful adjustments, if there's no safety valve,
then the only way for those rising powers feeling constrained and resentful to change the reality they dislike is through force. through violent challenge. You either provide an orderly way to adapt, Carr implies, or you build up pressure until the whole thing explodes.
And we saw that happen, didn't we? He points to examples.
Oh, absolutely. He points to the League's total paralysis when major powers were actually challenged. Think about the Japanese invasion of Manchuria in 1931. Or the Italian invasion of Abyssinia, Ethiopia in 1935.
War happened.
The collective security system, the idea that everyone would bang up on an aggressor, it just dissolved instantly because the major powers, Britain, France, prioritized their own immediate perceived national interests over their abstract commitment to upholding international law or defending weaker states. It showed the system's weakness when real power politics kicked in.
It's a sobering lesson in the limits of ideals when faced with hard power. Okay, let's try and pull out maybe three core themes or messages from Carr that are really essential for, well, for anyone trying to understand how the world works, even beyond international relations.
Okay, three big takeaways. First, I'd say, is the relativity of morality in politics. Carr really forces you to confront the idea that when a state talks about international morality or universal values, it's often just the self-serving morality of the most powerful states dressed up in language that sounds universal.
So for you, the listener, this means developing a healthy dose of critical skepticism, right? Whenever any nation invokes these grand universal values to justify its actions, Carr is whispering in your ear, ask cui bono.
Who benefits?
Who really benefits if this policy, this value is enforced? Good question. What's the second takeaway?
Second, power is the essential currency. You just can't understand politics or strategy for that matter if you ignore power. Any effective policy, any plan for change, Carr insists, has to start with a ruthless, realistic assessment of the power landscape. Who has influence? Who controls resources? Who can actually make things happen or stop them?
How does that apply if you're not, you know, negotiating treaties, say, in a business setting or even a community group conflict?
Well, it suggests that simply appealing to fairness or what should happen is often not enough. It's secondary, Carr might argue, to understanding the underlying distribution of influence, resources, leverage. Who has the power in that situation? Understanding the what is of power is critical before you can effectively push for the ought to be.
Right. Understand the real dynamics first. Okay,
yeah.
The third key theme.
The third is the necessity of synthesis. We touched on this. You can't just be a hard-nosed realist with no goals, nor a wide-eyed idealist with no grip on reality. Effective action, effective statesmanship, requires blending the moral vision, the utopian goal, the ought to be, with the practical means, the realist understanding of power and constraints.
The vision and the strategy.
Exactly. Think about applying this to a huge global challenge today, like, say, climate change. The moral urgency, the need to act, that's the utopian vision, right? It's essential.
Absolutely.
But Carr would remind us that the solutions have to be grounded in reality. They need to account for the economic interests, the technological limits, the power dynamics between major industrial nations. Without that realistic grounding, that strategic thinking, the moral urgency alone might not achieve much.
That makes a lot of sense. You know, this book is also packed with these really sharp, memorable lines, phrases that kind of encapsulate his thinking and just stick with you.
Oh, definitely. They really cut through the noise.
Like the ultimate realist axiom, maybe his most famous line, international politics, like all politics, is a struggle for power. Simple, stark. He's saying power isn't some unfortunate aberration. It's the fundamental engine.
It really is. And then there's his critique of how dominant groups talk. He says something like, the doctrine of the harmony of interests is the natural ideology of a dominant group.
Which identifies its own interest with the interests of the community as a whole.
Exactly. It's a powerful warning against self-serving rhetoric disguised as universal good. Always look at who's talking and what their position is.
And finally, that call for balance, avoiding both extremes. The utopian is necessarily voluntarist. The realist is tempted to make reality a god and to preach submission.
Mm-hmm. Don't be naively optimistic, thinking you can just will things into existence. But also, don't become so cynical that you just accept reality as unchangeable and give up trying to improve it. Find that middle ground.
That synthesis again.
That synthesis. It's surprisingly relevant today, isn't it? Carr's framework gives you a lens to analyze current geopolitics.
How so? Give us an example.
Well, think about the ongoing U.S.-China rivalry. You can absolutely view it through Carr's lens as a classic struggle, can't you? Between a status quo have power, the U.S., largely defending the international order it helped build.
And a rising revisionist have-not power China, feeling constrained by that order and seeking to change the rules to better suit its interests.
And notice how both sides make their case. They heavily employ that third type of power. Carr talked about power over opinion.
Using ideology, narratives.
Exactly. Framing their national interests as global goods, defending democracy versus promoting a community of shared future. The language changes, the specific ideology shift, but the underlying struggle for power and influence, using ideas as weapons, that feels very Carr.
It also helps explain why international institutions sometimes seem, well, ineffective, doesn't it? Like the UN Security Council often being paralyzed.
Very much so. Carr's analysis of the League of Nations' failures resonates there. Institutions are valuable, they provide forums, they establish norms. But, as Carr showed, they ultimately cannot constrain a major power, especially a permanent member of the Security Council, if that power is determined to defy the consensus or act in its perceived vital interest.
Power politics can overhear the rules.
When the stakes are high enough for the great powers, yes, it seems that way. The lesson isn't that institutions are useless, but that their effectiveness is often limited by the underlying power realities Carr described.
So, for anyone listening who's involved in any kind of strategy, business, nonprofit, policy, the takeaway is pretty clear.
Yeah, I think it is. If you're proposing a change, you have a vision that's your utopian goal. But Carr insists you must first ground that vision in a ruthless, honest, realistic assessment of the actual power landscape. Who has the resources? Who have the influence? What are the real constraints? You need that intellectual honesty about the what is.
Before you can effectively plan how to get to the ought to be.
Precisely. That intellectual honesty is maybe the biggest thing Carr demands of us.
That really hits home for me as a final thought on this deep dive. Just how revolutionary, almost shocking, his insight into the political nature of morality is. Carr doesn't just ask us to be realistic. He forces us to discard these comforting illusions we might have about international law or universal values always triumphing. He makes you achieve a kind of uncomfortable clarity by confronting where power really resides.
Yeah, it's not always comfortable reading. And for me, the profound, lasting lesson is maybe about adaptation, the imperative of adapting to change. Rigid international orders, whether it was the League of Nations back then or maybe aspects of our systems today, if they fail to provide legitimate, peaceful channels for adapting to shifts in power, for addressing grievances,
they risk facing violent challenges.
They inevitably invite challenges, often violent ones. That understanding the need for flexibility and mechanisms for peaceful change in a world where power is always shifting seems absolutely vital for navigating the complex, multipolar world we live in now.
A powerful and enduring message indeed. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.